Money Radio, thanks so much for joining us, and it is a pleasure to welcome Marion McGovern. She is an early entrepreneur in the gig economy. She founded M Squared Consulting, also Collaborous, a couple of companies that have done quite well and dealt with the gig economy. In addition, she has been writing about the gig economy, and the new book is entitled Thriving in the Gig Economy: How to Capitalize and Compete in the New World of Work by Marion McGovern. Thriving in the Gig Economy. Marion, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is a pleasure, Sinclair. Happy to be here.
All right, let's start with some basics. What is the gig economy? How do we really define it? And how is it different from on-demand or a sharing economy?
Well, a gig, by definition, is work of uncertain duration. So a gig started in the 1920s with jazz musicians. They'd get a club date. It was a gig.
Playing a gig.
Playing a gig, absolutely.
Yeah.
And gig work has been around for a long time. People have moonlit. They've consulted. They've done things on their own. The focus of it now, though, and why it's in the news and on the tip of everyone's tongue, is because of the technology that has been brought to bear to create more efficient markets in the talent that is available. And I'm glad you brought up the issue of on-demand and sharing, because these three economies are similar, but they are not synonyms for each other, and many people use them interchangeably. On-demand reflects those folks who are doing gigs that are very urgent, and there is a half-life to the time of that. So you want that driver to pick you up in the next 5 minutes. It's not something you're going to wait a day or 2 days for. Similarly, you know, someone to come deliver something to you or pick up your dry cleaning or whatever it is. There's a convenient factor. It tends to be lower skilled or semi-skilled, so it's not tremendous expertise that might be, you know, scientific, financial, creative. It's a little more able to be considered a commodity. The sharing economy, however, is different. Sharing involves a physical asset. If I want to get an Airbnb in Phoenix for spring training, I'm getting that property because it's available and I'm going to be there, and it's on a really cool golf course. You may be a great host, and you may have done a lot of work to prepare that home for me, but the truth of the matter is, your services as a host is not what I'm purchasing. Mm-hmm. I'm purchasing the use of your property for the time that I'm there. So it is a sharing economy play in my construction, not a gig economy one.
All right. Let's take a look at the size of the gig economy, because it has been growing rapidly. A lot of people don't realize how rapid the growth has been and what a huge part of the overall economy it now is.
It really is. That's so true. There are estimated to be about 41 million people that are operating in the gig economy. But more important than that, there are another 14 million that are thinking about it. So that's an enormous slice of the working population. In fact, some economists have said that the job growth in recent years has largely been fueled by independent work. It crosses all boundaries in terms of type of work. You know, there is everything from data scientists to web designers to financial people to drivers and delivery folks. There are digital platforms for all of that. There are digital platforms for makeup artists, for example, one called glam.com, where you could be in a movie needing a makeup artist, or you could be going to a fancy party and you want a makeup artist.
Not a big requirement for radio, but still.
True. But there are lots of players. It represents a significant portion of GDP, $1.2 trillion was estimated for 2017. So it is a big part of the economy. And again, it's far more than just what makes the news, which tends to be, you know, the lawsuits against Uber and things like that.
How do we measure this gig economy, though? I mean, each month the government puts out the non-farm payroll report. They tell us that the unemployment rate is 4.4%. But we've got all these people doing side gigs, or maybe they've got a gig that's their main thing. Maybe they are full-time at what they do. Maybe they even hire a few people along the way. How do
Correct.
We measure it?
You know, that quite frankly, is a tremendous problem. The government used to have something they called the contingent labor index, but they stopped collecting that in, I want to say, 2005. So there isn't really data. There isn't data because, you know, one way to figure it out might be for 1099s, because a lot of independent workers are not working on a W-2. They're working on a 1099 for their tax purposes. But 1099s also include things like dividends and stuff. So there's nothing clean in terms of the data out there. So you have to rely on industry folks that do studies. There's one company called MBO Partners that has the longest running study. They've been tracking the data since 2012. So that was the data that I was quoting you earlier. But McKinsey has just done a study. Pew Research has done studies. And part of the challenge of looking at these numbers is that they will define categories slightly different. So as long as, I mean, I think everybody does center around the notion of about 40 million is kind of where they land in terms of how many people are there. But the measurement is tough. They are reinstating, the government is reinstating a measurement to track this. You know, why it takes so long, I don't know. They announced last year that they would reinstate it, and it's not going to happen until 2019. So at some point in the future, there will be government data.
It'll be helpful.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of implications that come along with this. People working in the gig economy, they're not building up a pension as we used to know it. They're not able to get unemployment insurance, probably not disability insurance. Nobody's going to give them a gold watch when they finally stop gigging. What about the security side of things for people? You know, there's something to be said for and against a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Some people feel more secure working independently because they feel this is especially true after the Enron situation. That's when, you know, things started changing, where they feel that they are no longer subject to the whims of a corporation to decide to close their division or whatever. But the issues you speak to are very true. And to the extent that the government hasn't sorted out how to deal with this, although Senator Mark Warner has just proposed a bill on portable benefits with the idea that let's fund pilot programs, whether it's with nonprofits or digital platforms or whatever, where we can figure out different models for how we might be able to offer bonus pools for these populations and see which of these models work well. So hopefully that bill will pass. You know, I know there's been a bit of a logjam in Congress recently, but that's progress. And quite frankly, the private sector has stepped in. You know, there are one area of insurance that is really tough for independents is professional liability insurance, much like the malpractice that a doctor would have. And there's one company here in San Francisco, a startup insurance firm, Bunker Insurance, that has created a platform for both companies who want to engage consultants who would have professional liability insurance and consultants who want to secure it. So, you know, people are stepping up to do that, and there are people that are stepping up to create different kinds of retirement products for the self-employed, for the independent workers. People can look on peers.org is a great site where they list providers of health insurance and different sorts of retirement products. The Freelancers Union is another place where folks can look to find out more resources that might be of value.
It also even carries over to something as fundamental to the economy as Social Security. A 1099 doesn't pay you into Social Security.
Actually, when you pay your independent taxes, when you pay your taxes, you are supposed to pay your portion of Social Security. Actually, you paid both portions.
So you paid double.
Correct. So you pay, that is part of the price. And, you know, quite frankly, that there is a lot to learn about being self-employed and being an independent worker. So there is sort of, you know, people do need to educate themselves. It is like you're running a business.
And there's that whole idea of the 1099 versus the W-2 and which one is really accurate. I mean, this is a fight that Uber has been dealing with recently.
Yes, and, you know, the Collaboris, the company I started, was precisely that. It was a compliance company to employ consultants if they needed to be employed because of the nature of the work. So I'm not an employment lawyer, but I do have a fairly deep knowledge in this area. And I, for one, am quite happy that the Uber lawsuit is happening, because part of the problem is the ambiguity in U.S. employment law around who really is an employee and who is a contractor. So hopefully this very high-profile situation may bring some clarity to this this problem, because in some cases we had situations where we would introduce a research consultant who would never even set foot in the client's facility. You know, it was going to be a white paper on some technology or whatever, but there was such a concern about the government sort of coming back and saying, oh my gosh, they're still your employee, that they would want this individual to be employed anyway, even though the nature of the work was very independent. So, you know, it's not illegal to be a 1099 contractor, but, you know, the pendulum had sort of slipped back to make it be a very risk-averse posture.
And this also raises some serious questions about, we talk about loyalty in the workplace. Some corporations and businesses say, we just can't find loyal employees. Employees, meanwhile, say, I don't find the corporation or the company being loyal back to me.
Correct.
You know, do you get some advantage by having someone work as an employee? How does that whole loyalty concept work in a gig economy?
You know, it's interesting because right now, you know, one of the big sort of terms of art is employee engagement, and there are companies like Glassdoor that, you know, rate employers for what do their employees really think of them, and how good an employer are they, and do you want to go work for that employer? And so people are trying to be the employer of choice. And what I've suggested to a lot of company executives is, you know, talent is essential for you to run your business, and whether that talent is an employee that you want to keep as your and retain as a long-term employee, or whether that talent is a consultant who comes in and works alongside with of your employees, you need to be not only the employer of choice, you need to be the client of choice. You need to be a good client. You need to offer interesting opportunities. You need to pay on time, quite basically. But you also need to be the kind of company that this gig economy marketplace participant is going to want to work for.
Who has the advantage? I mean, one of the things that we've talked about recently is with the unemployment rate dropping down so low, we haven't seen an increase in wages, which we would normally see in a tight labor market. Is the gig economy suppressing wage growth now? Is it keeping employment cost low?
You know, there have been people that have suggested that we have a new normal. You know, it used to be that you lost a job and you went on unemployment for a while and you kind of went back in the marketplace. You know, now you could lose a job and you could go drive for Uber. So the valleys potentially, because of the opportunity that is now available to pick up side gigs while you're waiting for something more perfect, the valleys are changing. The peaks and valleys are changing. So there are certain economists who have said, you know, we really need to rethink how we compare today's data to the past.
Oh, yeah. This is some really interesting stuff here. Thriving in the Gig Economy by Marion McGovern. Thriving in the Gig Economy. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking today with Marion McGovern, the author of a new book, Thriving in the Gig Economy, how to capitalize and compete in the new world of work, thriving in the gig economy. And it raises so many interesting questions. And clearly, you have a lot of expertise in the gig economy. One thing that has enabled the gig economy to really exist is the role of technology. And you address that in the book. This is how we actually put independent contractors, giggers, to work. This is how it all comes together, isn't it?
Well, you know, there have been independent contractors working for years. It's just that now there is more technology to make the marketplace more efficient, if you will. That said, as part of the book, I joined, you know, 12 of these platforms that I was theoretically qualified for. Some of them I really wasn't, but they took me anyway. And it was interesting to see the types of things I would get suggested for and the vetting process that they went through. I mean, some of them are very rigorous, and they ask for far more information because their algorithms are only as good as how well they know you. And their algorithms are only as good as, you know, the fact that you applied for one gig, didn't get it. What was that about you? Or you applied for one gig and did get it. So that's more data that they have about you. So the more you work through these platforms, the more they know. That said, you know, some of them just use LinkedIn profiles. And my LinkedIn profile, I was the chair of a humanitarian nonprofit that did a lot of work in Africa. So I got projects, you know, ideas that were, you know, building wells in Uganda, which is not my skill set. So that particular algorithm wasn't on point.
Can we just do it all with algorithms, or do we still need the human?
Interestingly, a lot of them are adding, like, concierge services. They're adding the ability to have a human actually look at this information. And some of them are also doing, you know, there are lots of, there's lots of science around how people make decisions when they're confronted with lots of choices. And if you have too many choices, you get into kind of decision panic. So, you know, a number of them will come back and say, oh, actually, these are the three people you should look at.
What about?
Now, we know there are 500 that came up in your search, but just check out these three.
Yeah. What about the future of the gig economy? Because you dealt with that in the book as well. And it's something that is going to be one thing we do know, and through reading through the book, you'll quickly realize this is going to be a big part of the future moving forward.
It really is. And I think, again, as I mentioned, there are ways that we need to just recognize we need to be prepared for it, not the least of which is the educational system. You know, individuals need to know how to run their own business. They need to understand kind of financial basics, and that's whether or not they're, you know, an animator or a copywriter or a financial person. So there are skills that we need to make sure are getting taught in schools early on. I remember actually, because I always talk to my Uber drivers, you know, and there was a fellow who was a teacher who said, you know, I've been a W-2 employee all my life. I had no idea how to actually maximize what I was earning through Uber. You know, he knew he could deduct his gas. He didn't really know he could deduct part of his tires. So there are some basic skills that we need to make sure are there. And, you know, companies need to take away some of the barriers, you know, to the extent that younger people, more millennials are jumping in here. They still need opportunities to grow. I mean, everyone needs opportunities to grow, but, you know, people who are newer in the workforce need to have training opportunities. And it used to be, you know, back in the day, you join a Xerox and, boy, you became one of the best salespeople around because, you know, they had such a great sales training program. Some of those training opportunities need to be offered to the independent workers as well as your employees.
Well, if you'd like,
that's how you become the client of choice.
And if you'd like to find out how to become the client of the of choice, if you'd like to find out how to thrive in the gig economy, there's a book for that, Thriving in the Gig Economy: How to Capitalize and Compete in the New World of Work by Marion McGovern. Thriving in the Gig Economy, very interesting, very insightful, and a lot of fun and interesting to read. Marion McGovern, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.